I'm so lucky. I mean, I'm so lucky. Look at you, and look at me.
Hey, I mean, come on. Look at you. You're smart. You're attractive. You love the original Star Wars trilogy because it's all about storytelling and myth before CGI ruined everything. I mean, come on. What girl wouldn't want to be with you?
A shocking number, actually.
Well, you know what? It's their loss. You show me a guy who loves Empire, and I will show you a guy who's not afraid of his imagination. Like when Luke gets to the cave, and he asks Yoda what's in there, and Yoda says...
Only what you take with you.
But he goes in anyway.
Yes.
He's not afraid of his own mind.
Walking the path of the Jedi, that's why.
That's you! You're Luke! Didn't you just go?
Listen, I'll be right back. Just don't go anywhere, okay?
I'm not gonna go anywhere.
Okay, cool. But really, don't go anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, to a very special edition of the DVD Marquee on HTF Radio, sponsored by the Home Theater Forum and I Crave DVD. I'm Jeffrey Rosato. As hard as it is for modern-day moviegoers and home theater buffs to believe, there was once a period in history when the summer blockbuster didn't exist. That's not to say that this time of year hasn't been without films aimed at the vacation set. Like Spring Break and Christmas Time, Hollywood's marketing machine always had the kids in mind with features released especially for them, but event movies that adults and perhaps even the kids could tattle on for never really had a timetable. So way back when, the lights of Pirates of the Caribbean, The Da Vinci Code, and Superman Returns would have graced theater screens during the early fall and late winter, which has come to be known as periods for more serious, adult, and lest we forget, Academy Award-minded material. Yes, in a time period far, far away, there were good movies to be found 12 months out of the year, alongside the so-so stuff. But on the weekend of June 20th, 1975, that all changed.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws.
On this special edition of the DVD Marquee, Summer Movie Memories, a countdown of 10 films that helped the era of the summer blockbuster begin, evolve, and change for the past 31 years. In addition to waxing nostalgic, we'll also tell you about these films' companion DVDs and whether they live up to the legacies they've established. Now joining me today is the newest contributor to our show, my longtime friend, extraordinary gentleman, and fellow movie buff supreme, Stan Williams. Stan, welcome to the DVD Marquee.
Thanks, Jeff. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you aboard. Now, these aren't necessarily movies that we would put in our top 10 all-time favorite summer movies ultra geek list.
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, some of them may belong in that list, but really, I think, you know, these are the ones, I don't know, if nothing else, that we just have fond memories of, I would think.
Exactly, yeah. And a few that made a difference, for better or for worse.
Right.
And the first one that definitely comes to mind is Jaws, the film that we just heard a clip from, 1975, June 20th.
Yeah, it seems weird now because everything now pretty much comes out of Memorial Day.
Right.
And even Memorial Day had been seen for the longest time, I think, as a kickoff of the summer movie season, but it's getting earlier and earlier now. I think...
Christmas.
Yeah, you could argue now. I mean, hell, I think sometimes it even starts in, may even start in March.
I can remember seeing this movie around 6 months to nearly a year later after it came out, because back in the day, we didn't have these multiplexes. We had these single screen theaters, and I remember it was a theater called the Westbury, and what happened was is that it was held over for like the sixth consecutive month. You know, I could still see the paper.
Mind. I love that, and I really miss that when a huge movie would come out, and we're not talking about Jaws right now, but later, like say one of the Star Wars movies would come out, and they would, and everybody knew, you know, like everybody knows The Empire Strikes Back is going to be huge, right? But you look in the paper, and it's like after it's been playing for a week, held over, second big week.
You never see that.
And I think if I were a director, I would be insulted. Because that's pretty much the paper going, we didn't think it'd last. We thought it, oh well.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Broadway if you think about it now, because, you know, right now, you know, the print is so small in the newspaper, you can barely make out the showtime, so mm-hmm. thank God for the web in that mm-hmm. aspect. I was, like, mesmerized by this movie, and I didn't think it was as good as the book. Believe it or not, I actually read the book, unlike most kids my age, before I went to see the movie, but it was pretty darn good. I can remember my brother talking to my sister-in-law and going, silliest thing I ever saw, but Jeff, he loved it.
Oh, I remember Jaws, and I would have been six, I think, when Jaws came out. And what I remember about that is everybody had seen it except me. And it became, I think it became the first movie I was obsessed with. And I knew this movie was big when even my aunt had seen it. And I remember asking her, and it's like I would ask everybody. It's like, so what happens after this? And what happened after this? And mm-hmm. I think Jaws may have been the first movie I went to where I knew the whole movie just through word of mouth before I even walked into the theater.
You know, the thing that stands out about that movie is that you didn't really see the shark until like an hour into it.
Right.
And I always found that kind of fascinating and very effective.
Oh, that's, you know, that's legendary. I mean, you know, any time they talk about Jaws, I mean, that they talk about, you know, the problems they had with the shark.
And, you know, I can remember the scene where, you know, I hope we don't spoil this for anybody, because we're assuming that most of you guys have seen this movie. But if you, you know, if you haven't seen it, you know, we're going to put some music on right now and wait and, you know, just come back in about a minute. It's like when I sat down to watch this on DVD a few years ago, it all came back. The girl at the beginning of the movie, you know, getting, you know, dismembered. The kid getting attacked.
Mm-hmm.
The blood coming from Robert Shaw's mouth. I mean, you just never forget, you know, and what a great job he did in that movie.
Oh, yeah, and aside from, you know, a few unfortunate sideburns, I mean, it's hardly dated, and I remember I watched this just about a year or so ago. I hadn't seen it in quite a while. Robert Shaw and the Indianapolis story. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're walking out of the room when he's doing that, you're right. God, you're not paying attention. That's just jaw-dropping stuff.
And of course, the nails on the blackboard.
Yeah. How old were you when Jaws came out?
I was like 13 years old.
Did you know there was something different about it?
You know, I didn't really realize it at the time, but it was certainly the most adult movie I think I'd seen at that point, or adult movie that I was able to recall with such clarity. Anyway, is there anything you wanted to add?
Do you want to talk about the DVD a little bit?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the DVD, and thank God they remastered this. About a year ago, they came out with a 30th anniversary mm-hmm. edition.
Yeah.
And the thing that Stan and I felt that was so great about this particular version, which is available from Universal Home Video, it had the original mono soundtrack. And we talked about this one night, the stereo version.
Yeah. I'm not the audio geek so much, but yeah, I could definitely notice in the 5.1 mix. It seemed like they went back and tried to re-record the whole thing, and it just didn't work. It wasn't the movie I remembered. And darn it, I knew it, because whenever ABC would play it, I would have my little tape recorder. Yeah. You know, in front of the TV back before we had VCRs. Why, in my day, yeah, not to sound like that, but yeah, and I, you know, I would sit there and I would roll the little tape recorder, and I would play that tape over and over, and I would have, you know, all the dialogue memorized. So listening to that 5.1 track, it's like the movie I remember.
It was a noble effort, you know, because, you know, John Williams' score, you know, one of the best. But there were times when I noticed that maybe some of the dialogue was missing, and the shark sounded like the MGM Lion or something like that. It was just awful, you know, and just the Fate stereo was even worse. I think they used Fate stereo on the VHS edition, mm-hmm. but the 30th anniversary edition, for those of you who haven't gotten around to it yet, the first movie has the film only with a never-before-available interview with director Steven Spielberg.
That lasts, what, about 90 seconds?
90 seconds, yes. Yeah. Some exclusive. Thanks.
Never-before-available does not necessarily mean good. Not slamming the disc, I'm just saying.
But disc 2 is where the meat and potatoes of the good stuff is. The making of Jaws, which was abbreviated on the original release, much to the horror of people that had the Laserdisc way back when. And it has production photos, storyboards, marketing junk. Well, not really junk. It's, you know, depending on how, you know, you view junk. And the Jaws phenomenon. Your feelings on this DVD, Stan?
Good. Pick it up.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now. 20th Century Fox and George Lucas, the man who brought you American Graffiti, now bring you an adventure unlike anything on your planet. Star Wars.
Here they come.
Okay, you can't talk about summer movies without covering the two big daddies, right? Jaws and Star Wars.
Okay.
Star Wars, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
I think I've heard of it, yeah.
First off, there's nothing new I can say about Star Wars. I think it's been covered to death. But for me, I don't know, I feel lucky to this day that I was 8 years old when Star Wars came out, because it was like a lightning bolt to the brain, and I think anybody who was my age, you know, at that time, felt exactly the same way, and I guess even people who were older.
Yeah, I remember seeing this movie at the old University 6, which at the time was the University 4. The first time I'd ever been at a multiplex before, or what would become known as a multiplex, or as Billy Crystal calls it, C1 movie here 4. It was so different from anything I'd ever seen before, and aside from the Apollo missions, about the only thing space-wise I was into was the Jetsons. So it was like going to a whole new world for me. I mean, the characters were so well-drawn, and actually, what was the first?
The Star Destroyer.
Okay, right. And the minute that vehicle came up after the Skrull, telling us all about the back history and all that, it was just, I find myself speechless.
Well, if you think about it, Star Wars was something, up until that time, I think in a weird way, it's something our lives were missing that we didn't realize we were missing. Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, it does. I mean, it just seemed to fill a void in a lot of people's lives, you know. I loved music, and that's still probably my biggest love, but second, and a very close second to that, is films, and, you know, just, I cannot imagine my high school years without this movie.
Well, in a way, I think that's a good analogy, music. I mean, repeat viewings. I mean, before Star Wars, watching Star Wars in a way is like listening to a song, because it's like, you know the beats, you know the rhythms, you've seen it so many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even, you could almost say, like, I remember this specifically as the lines. You know, the line, it's something you really don't see anymore. The
right.
line to get, it was like trying to get into a club, you know, with lines stretched all the way around the building. And I mean, yeah, we don't have to deal with that today, but in a way, I kind of miss that, you know, because it made it special, because you had to wait for it a little bit, you know, you had to be in that line out in the 90 degree heat, slowly inching around the front of the theater.
You know, I must have seen it earlier than you, because the day that I went, it was in the afternoon, it was like 1 o'clock, and there wasn't a line. I don't think the word of mouth had gotten out in our neck of the woods like it had, say, in cities like L.A., New York, Chicago.
Oh, sure. Because Star Wars, I think it opened, everybody probably looks back and thinks, you know, it opened on, like, you know, 1,000 screens or something. I think it opened in, what, like 5-6 cities the first weekend, and then slowly spread out?
Right. It's been really neat over the years to see it. It's like The Wizard of Oz, in a way. Just spans the generation.
Yeah, one of the weird, well, I guess it's really not really irony in my life, but I remember I didn't want to see Star Wars because I was afraid. I remember the poster of Luke holding up the lightsaber over Leia. You know, I was an 8-year-old kid, and I saw that poster, and I thought, this guy is, like, attacking this girl, and the movie would be about this guy slicing this girl in half. My mom, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, I don't know, it had probably been out for a while, I'm not really sure, but said, hey, let's go see Star Wars, and boy, I bet she regrets that decision.
Because I'm telling you, folks, Stan Williams is probably one of the biggest Star Wars fans I've ever known in my lifetime. And that's hard to believe, because my brother, you know, he took up like half of our house with the collectible stuff.
I don't know. I think there are a lot of people who are more diehard. I don't think you could be the age I was when that movie came out and, in a way, not be a huge Star Wars geek.
Yeah. Do you feel that it had a character that everybody could identify with? I mean, you had Luke, he was the dreamer. Princess Leia, you know, someone the girls could look up to. Mm-hmm. Han, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, One of the interesting things, one of the things I really miss about George Lucas, if you look at...
Is he dead?
And this is something that bothers me about, like, the DVDs, the Star Wars DVDs.
It's right.
Like, okay, they commissioned this documentary, and it's a great documentary. It's a very entertaining, well-done documentary.
Mm-hmm.
But they never include, and for me, growing up, this was as big a part of it than anything. Remember the old making-of specials they would show on TV?
We were watching that the other night. You know, I did not see it when it was on the air.
I miss that. I mean, granted, looking at them now, you know, they can be kind of cheesy or whatever. But if you look at those, when they're interviewing Lucas, he's talking about story. And when's the last time you heard Lucas talk about story and not green screen?
I think probably Star Wars.
Yeah.
I have no other answer.
You're right.
That.
It's back when it was about, and this is, again, this has been covered to death by other people, you know, more eloquent than me. It was, you know, it was about myth. It was about story.
It's interesting that you touch on that, because Lucas did not direct the second Star Wars movie, right?
Exactly. I actually read a quote from him one time. I believe he said Empire didn't have to be as good as it was. And I don't know. As a filmmaker, why would you ever say that? I mean, he's granted, we look at the quality of the prequels, and I think everybody, you know, most everybody doesn't think very highly of those, at least in an artistic way. But I mean, you can write for kids and not write down to kids or write down to everybody else. And he wasn't writing down, I believe, in the first trilogy, or at least the first couple of them.
The second one I love so much because it wasn't a carbon copy of the first one. I mean, everybody seemed to have grown up a little bit.
Empire, I remember Empire was the first time I believe I saw the local news covering a movie opening.
Yes, it was very huge.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, and I remember the lines were a little bit longer this time for me, even though I caught it probably the first weekend.
And I still believe for anybody, any of the kids today watching the Star Wars movies for the first time, I think that there should be a law that they should have to wait 3 years between viewings. Like, if you're going to show little Timmy Star Wars and he thinks it's great, and he's like, is there another one? Yeah, Timmy, 2009. I'll break that out.
Right, because, you know, some of it's a little heavy. I mean, you know, just, we know the big revelation. Luke finds out that Vader is his father. I mean, talking about heavy stuff. And it must have been heavier for you because you were much younger than I was at the time.
I don't know if I would say it was heavy per se, but it definitely took it to another level. Star Wars was just one thing, and then Empire took it and just raised it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I still have a theory that I think Star Wars is really still popular to this day because of The Empire Strikes Back and because of Irvin Kershner. Because Kershner came in there and did this. Took time with the actors. And yeah, it has the dialogue problems that all the other ones have, but there's a spark to it. There are real people playing these roles. I mean, and I don't mean to slam anybody in the prequels. I think you know what I mean. I mean, you can see there's a spark there. You know, there's an energy there. In the prequels, it seems to be, you know, the Butler High School dramatic players present Star Wars Episode 5. But yeah, it was great. And it was dark. And that was cool, you know, especially when you're, you know, a 10-year-old kid. But the point I was trying to get to earlier is Kershner. I think Kershner deserves as much credit, almost as much credit as Lucas does for Star Wars, for taking it to that level. We got to cover the third one, Jedi, which ushered in a new era of the blockbuster, the summer movie, The Inevitable Disappointment.
The Inevitable Disappointment.
Because, think about it, up to that time, we'd had a good ride, you know, Star Wars, you know, and Jaws, Empire, and then here comes Jedi, which is okay for a while.
But then you had the Ewoks come
in. Didn't you walk out of there, and it's, you know, I think it's the first, it may have been the first time we walked out of the movie theater going, it was good.
Yeah.
You know? It's what I call movie denial. And it happens way too commonly now. It's like when you're so hyped for a movie that you walk out of it and you don't want to admit to yourself that it was bad. It was disappointing. It didn't live up to it. And I'm sure there were other disappointments before that, but I think really Jedi kind of ushered in that era.
And I think right after that big scene where Luke rescues Leia, you know, who had been trapped by the infamous Jabba the Hutt, it just seemed to kind of just go into kiddie mode for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did.
And I've always wondered, and you would probably know more about this than me, were the Ewoks kind of a deal where, you know, Lucas kind of got into that merchandising frame of mind because, you know, they were cuddly, they were cute and everything, but just, you know, not really what I would call elemental to this kind of story.
I don't know. As cynical as I am about Lucas now, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that one because I think he originally wanted Wookiees for that, and he says he wanted Wookiees, may have cost too much, been too hard to do, I'm not sure, so he made Ewoks. I'm like, okay, I'll give you that. I see the whole nature versus technology thing you're going for here, so, but I don't know, the cynical, I think maybe somewhere in the cynical regions of my brain, I go, yeah, merchandising.
Yeah, and at the same time, Harrison Ford, to me, correct me if I'm wrong, was barely in this movie.
Yeah, I think, was he on painkillers the whole time, or he looked moderately uncomfortable, but of course I've never seen Harrison Ford look comfortable. Come to think of it, but...
Well, he was comfortable in the first one. I really, you know, his attitude in the first movie.
Oh, yeah.
I loved it.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, he was like every jock I knew in high school.
Well, I don't know.
Well, maybe every cool jock.
I don't know. Based on the school I went to, that's a bit of an oxymoron. I went to the one school where on Earth where liking Star Wars actually made you a nerd.
Right.
So that's why I'm so messed up today.
Well, it wasn't that way where I went. I mean, you know, I can still remember the Star Wars shirts, you know, the Ranger shirts and stuff like
but
that.
But I fondly recall when Harrison Ford was alive.
Well, I think he was probably still nursing injuries from Raiders of the Lost Ark, if you put it, you know, you want to think about it in that way. Maybe that's why he just necessarily sleepwalked through this third
installment. I think he was embarrassed, and I think it's kind of fun to watch in an almost kind of uncomfortable way.
Right, but for better, for worse, it is part of the Star Wars history, and we do have to give it its due. I mean, you know, as weak as it is.
It's just too bad Lucas won't give it its due on DVD.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that right now. Matter of fact, I want to ask you, since you're more up on this than I am, what are the current DVDs out there? I mean, two disc editions or just one disc? Or
Actually, there's two separate box sets out right now. One, the original version released in 2004, has all three movies, the special edition versions, and right. One disc of extras. Because, you know, the greatest trilogy of all time deserves, let's give it a disc. Right. You know, why they can't do two disc special editions for these, I don't know. There's also another version out that just contains the three movies without the bonus disc. And of course,
coming in September to a DVD store near you.
Yes, the same exact thing you bought, except with non-anamorphic versions of the original films, which, George Lucas, why do you hate me?
Well, I don't think he hates you, Stan. I think maybe you guys need to talk.
Has he?
I think I speak for hundreds of millions of people who aren't into this thing, like, you know, big fans like you are. It's like, you know, this is absolutely incredibly boneheaded and stupid.
It is. I don't get it. And I've done a few things myself, a few shorts and everything, and I certainly understand what it's like to do a version and not like it, and to keep tinkering with it and go, this is the version I like. This is what I was aiming for the whole time. But if you like the version I did the first time, great. Okay. You're like, here's both of them. I prefer this one, but if you like this one, here you go.
And Spielberg did the same thing for E.T. I mean, exactly. You know, what a classy act that was.
I don't get it.
And they're trying to make these excuses like, you know, oh, well, the master's gone. It's like, oh, my, there's got to be at least three or four other versions, interpositives or film tech talk that I don't necessarily understand or, you know, would, you know, want to take the time to understand. Just give me, you know, what I want or what everybody wants.
Exactly. It's what the insane. I don't understand his thinking. I mean, this is the guy who, you know, THX.
Right.
Come on, you know, he's all about, well, in this movie we can do these special effects and it's all technology, you know, where it used to be, you know, like I was saying earlier, it used to be about story.
The thing is that the first movie I thought benefited from the technology, whereas the other two were, you know, I didn't think they needed much tweaking in the first place because, you know, just it was like a quantum leap going from like Star Wars to The Empire Strikes Back as far as effects. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that from the first scene of the movie where they have this tremendous, you know, battle. Well, let me ask you this, Stan. Do you think that since next year will be the 30th anniversary that there could be kind of a change of heart on Lucasfilm's part?
I don't care anymore. I don't know. I'm sure there'll be different versions.
Or maybe he's saving it for high def. I mean, who knows? I mean, it's interesting, but just, you know, he should have done this a long time ago. I think we both agree on that.
It's certainly his right, and certainly within his rights as an artist. But, I mean, you could argue, I mean, Star Wars in a weird way, the phenomenon that it come, I think it does sort of belong to all of us. In a weird way, and I don't understand. I guess he thinks, you know, this is what I, you know, what I want future generations to see and everything.
Right.
I'm like, okay, well, give us our anamorphic DVDs, let us die, and then everybody will forget about it.
I think I'm with you there. I mean, you know, from somebody who saw the original films in the original theater, or actually, you know, when they were originally
which
released.
I believe was actually a cave, wasn't it, with a fire
yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, and a nice fan. Anyway, as Bruce Willis said in the Moonlighting episode one time, que sera, sera. I'm going to pick a wild card here for a film that I remember very well, Rocky II. Now, we talked about this the other night in a little pre-production meeting.
Was that the one with the boxing?
That was the one with the boxing, okay. Yes. Yeah, and the montage.
Yeah, is that, the one where he played the underdog.
Right,
yeah,
not the underdog.
Overcame all the odds. Yeah, okay.
Trying to say that it is, in a way, the same movie, and there were sequels before Rocky II. Yes, Godfather, what have you. But this was the first sequel to be released during the prime summer months, and it made, like, a ton of money. Outgrossed the first one, if I'm not mistaken.
What time of year did it come out?
Came out in June of 79. About 3 years after the first one, which came out in, actually, Rocky watched Star Wars. Kind of a small release and gradually went throughout the country after it got its Oscar nominations and what have you. And I still remember seeing the first one like it was yesterday. I mean, what an amazing story about an underdog. You know, just like the poster said, a million to one shot. You know, you had the little scrolling Rocky logo, and then the two came up, and then the crowd noise, and you're just right back where that first one came in. You know, it was just amazing. It was basically the same movie, but it had a different feel to it. Of course, everybody wanted the rematch. Who did not want a rematch before the movie even began? But it was like, is it going to happen? What's going to happen this time?
Was that the first time you had seen that happen? That sort of applause at just like to say the titles of a movie?
Oh, God. I can remember being at the Madison Theater during that first film, and I'd never heard applause during a movie in my life. People were actually watching this like they were watching a boxing match on television. And that appeal was just, you know, it translated instantly to the second one. I mean, there was like dead silence when Rocky II, you know, the logo, came strolling by. And I love this movie because it showed us, you know, a really average guy, you know, being thrust into the spotlight, not doing a very good job of it, you know, spending money like, you know, he had plenty of it to burn. And he didn't. And trying to do a television commercial and having a really embarrassing fact come out, you know, he couldn't read. Apollo's taunting him. Mickey, you know, played by the wonderful Burgess Meredith, you know, telling him that, you know, he didn't want to box anymore because of the eye injury. It was so severe that, you know, he couldn't see a punch coming. And Rocky goes, you know, we're still on window. Well, I don't think you've got it anymore, you know. And Mickey kind of just, you know, goes, and then slaps him right in the face, you know. That's what's gonna happen to you, kid, if you get back in the ring, you know. And just, I just love Burgess Meredith. I mean, this guy should have won an Oscar for every Rocky movie. I mean, he was just wonderful. And of course, we all know, you know, Apollo gets on the TV, starts doing his little routine, you know, and then Mick comes bursting there. I think we gotta clobber him, you know. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, and we get this basically the same thing, you know, the training montages, you know, working out, and then we have this little crisis, you know.
You've been listening to NPR's special adaptation of Rocky II, screenplay by Sylvester Stallone.
Okay, I think that stands to say, hey, let's go ahead and, you know, pick up the pace here.
Awesome, awesome Burgess Meredith.
Well, though, thank you very much.
I got to say.
I appreciate that. And that was non-rehearsed, ladies and gentlemen, by the way. But it was just, you know, it was a great movie, and I'm with Quentin too. Tarantino. I saw Quentin Tarantino on Tom Snyder one night on Tom Snyder's show saying that he thought it was better than the first one. I think it is a much better movie. It's got more spirit, more heart to it. And this was a period when they didn't make sequels for the bottom line. You know, it was sincere. They wanted to make a good film. So, Stallone wanted to make a good movie.
Right. So really, really, that's why you're including this in your summer movies. As you're saying, this sort of helped usher in the era of the sequel.
It ushered in the era of the sequel, and for better or worse.
So we have this movie to thank for Arthur II on the rocks.
And, you know, of course, the third Star Wars movie. Or, see, the thing is, the numbers of the Star Wars, I don't want to get into that, but just Return of the Jedi. I mean, just, you know, it did help lead to that. But, you know, in recent years, I think sequels have gotten a little bit better. You know, Spider-Man 2, I think it was better than the first movie. You know, I haven't seen the new Pirates film yet, but that seems to be getting a lot of good buzz. So I think we're in an era where people are trying to make a good follow-up. And back then, people like Stallone, Erwin Kirshner, you know, were making good films. They weren't thinking about this is a follow-up or this is number two or we're just going to do this for a paycheck or whatever.
Right. That's interesting. That's an interesting choice because when you say summer movies, I gotta admit that's not one that would jump out at me. But I think you make some really good points there. Well, I was kind of joking with it earlier. I mean, it is a very entertaining movie, and there's nothing wrong with that formula. I think, you know, it's like if you're going to do the formula, do it well. You know, that's all I ask. And Rocky II does it very well.
The third one I had some problems with, but just, you know,
is that the one where he played the underdog?
That's the one where he plays the underdog, behind, and then you've got boxing. The montage. Yeah, and Apollo doesn't die. Oh, anyway, foreshadowing. But
what was Burgess Meredith in it?
Yeah, Burgess Meredith was in it. And I think we better just halt there for people who haven't been as lucky as I was to see all of them back in the day. But Rocky, and I feel the same way that you did about Pirates. I am just praying that Rocky Balboa, a.k.a. Rocky VI, doesn't suck. But in the meantime, we have all the original movies still in print. This one is in, unlike the copy I have, it's in 16:9. Dolby Digital 5.1, and no English, mono, how dare they? But anyway, but we'll get to that another time. But I'm willing to bet the ranch that Sony, which now owns the MGM holdings, you know, films like Rocky and what have you, are going to capitalize on this big time when Rocky Balboa hits DVD, probably sometime in spring. I'm willing to bet we're going to have like a six-disc box. It's going to have extras. That's another thing about Rocky II I wasn't impressed with. You know, it doesn't have any bonuses at all, but I think that's going to change.
It is protected by forces beyond imagination. It is desired above all treasures on Earth by those who are good.
Trust me.
And those who are evil.
I'll tell you everything.
Yes, I know you will.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Let her go.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. A film from Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
If movies are a religion, I worship at the altar of Raiders of the Lost Ark. In terms of entertainment, I think it's the most purely entertaining movie I've ever seen. And it stays that way to this day. Part of that is probably nostalgia, I'm sure, because it got into my 12-year-old brain, made an impression, and it's still there. You know, like the really great movies you watch over and over and over again?
Uh-huh.
Do you ever do what I do? It's like you try to give yourself a little bit of movie amnesia. It's like you try to forget you've ever seen it. You try, there's that moment, and I'll go every couple of years. I'm lucky enough, you know, a theater around here or close to here we'll show it, you know, in an actual movie theater. And there's nothing I love better than going in there and just trying not to think about the fact that I've seen it so many times. And I get carried away, and I'm 12 years old every time I see it.
This was yet another movie I was a latecomer to. It was held over for like 9 months, you know.
That's one of the things I really remember about Raiders, because, I mean, everybody was expecting it for Empire,
right?
You know, which came out the year earlier. Everybody knew that was going to be huge. This one came out, and it stuck around, and it stuck around, and it stuck around. So I think, you know, there were theaters who played this for like a year, over a year, mm-hmm. And that's amazing. And I miss that, you know, because the way it is now, a movie comes out, it makes all of its money on opening weekend. 2-3 weeks later, you've forgotten all about it. There's some, you know, something new and shiny,
right,
and different opening. And I miss that. I mean, I miss knowing that, you know, Raiders is going to be there all summer. So I'll go see it in June, you know, and maybe in July. I'm lucky enough, my mom will take me back again. Hey, August, Raiders is still showing. Great. Great. I'll go see it again. It was like a friend who came to visit for the summer.
So you're saying, without really saying, is that we need to petition the DVD companies to kind of hold back the release windows for a while.
No, I'm not saying that. I just miss when the movie was able to breathe. You know, it seems like, and that's something I kind of want to, I mean, everybody's seen Raiders, you know, there's nothing new under the sun I can say about it. But really, when I think of Raiders, I think of the summer of 81, which to me, and I could be wrong, and please, anybody out there, feel free to give us your thoughts on this. 1981, to me, seems like the first real summer movie season.
It does, yeah.
You had Raiders, you had Superman 2, and Stripes. And I remember what a unique thing it was that there were three movies that were that huge, all out around the same time.
And they stuck around for a while.
Yeah, and I can't remember a year before that where there seemed to be that many movies. And of course now, I mean, three, it sounds like a ridiculous number because we get, you know, more big movies than that in a month now.
What do you have any thoughts about the... I know what you think about the second one.
You know what? After watching the DVD, the second one actually holds up a lot better than you think it will.
You think so?
I was genuinely surprised. I was talking about movie denial with Return of the Jedi. I remember seeing Temple of Doom and just walking out of there going, it was great. You know, it was just amazing. And then, you know, a little while later, I kind of realized it's not. Because you know why I love Raiders? I love Raiders because in that movie, Harrison Ford is playing a character. He's playing a man whose name happens to be Indiana Jones.
Right.
And it's the way I look at it. He's this man who's kind of thrown into the situation. By the time Temple of Doom comes around, and I'm not slamming the movie, I still love all three movies. It's almost like he's playing our perception of what we think Indiana Jones is.
In a more cartoony kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like he's no longer a man just wearing a hat. It's Harrison Ford wearing a, quote, Indiana Jones hat, unquote. you know what I mean? I miss the grittiness the first one had.
What do you think he got it back in the third one? You know, the third one is probably my least favorite, but I still loved it.
I loved it too. It's one I haven't watched in a while, but I think I from things some of the things I read on the net, I think it's kind of weird. I think Temple of Doom has kind of gone up in people's opinions, and I think Last Crusade has kind of gone down a little bit, because I think a lot of people kind of look at Last Crusade as a bit of a comedic remake of Raiders. The thing about Raiders, if you go back and look at that movie, there's a meme streak in it, because the whole joy in Raiders, what made Harrison Ford our movie god basically at the time, not to get too goofy, is the way he takes a beating. It's fun to watch him get beat up.
Well, it's also fun to see him get beat up, but it was also fun to see him just take a gun out and shoot that wise guy with a big sword or blade or whatever it was.
And the thing that amazes me still now to this day, if I could see this movie with an audience, I guess a huge laugh. I think that's great.
And it was an improv, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think everybody pretty much knows that story by now. Ford had a case of dysentery, I believe. They had a big fight scene they were supposed to shoot.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the DVD, which surprisingly has George Lucas's name attached to it, but it's not that bad.
I don't mean to just slam George Lucas. I mean, that's sort of in vogue. But again, Mr. Lucas, why? Why do you hate me? No, it's a good DVD set. I have the same problems with it I have with Star Wars. Don't get me wrong, the picture and sound are amazing. Great documentary. Again, it's the three movies.
And they're not available separately, right?
No, the three movies and one disc of extras. And again, there's an excellent documentary, The Making of Raiders of the Lost Ark, that has been available on VHS. I believe it was on PBS a while back. And, of course, do you remember there was a special called Great Movie Stunts, Raiders of the Lost Ark?
I remember that, yeah.
It's kind of back when it's like the network would try to do. It's like, okay, it's going to be the making of Raiders of the Lost Ark, but we're going to throw in some other movies too. And it's great because it's hosted by Harrison Ford, who looks as uncomfortable as he looks in any interview. It's just, damn it, we have to have Harrison Ford on DVD going, "I looked pretty scared in that scene, didn't I?" Well... I'd have been crazy not to be.
You make him sound like the Simpsons character. Oh, my.
You know, come to think of it, Harrison Ford, Troy McClure. I can see
the similarities. You know, well, I can, speaking for myself. This title of the show is Summer Movie Memories, but I want to jump in here to the hopeful future. They're still working on a script, or is it done, or are they going to start shooting? What's the latest on this?
Rumors have been flying on this one for years. It sounds like they actually are pretty close to getting this thing done. I don't know. On a personal note, I'm sick of all the Harrison Ford is old jokes. Because I think anybody who thinks he's too old for this character doesn't understand the character.
Exactly.
It's like I said earlier, it's great fun to watch him get beat up. And the thought of a 64-year-old Indiana Jones, just kind of this grizzled kind of Humphrey Bogart type character, I'm nuts. I'm nuts about that idea.
And you know, we've got people like, you know, Clint Eastwood and Sean Connery. You know, they have moved into their 70s and they're still doing great work. So.
My dad is 74 and he could kick my ass. So... I don't think age means, of course, this is another topic for something that has nothing to do with movies. Maybe Dr. Jeff, maybe that show we could do. But I don't think age means as much as it used to.
I completely agree.
I think what we think of as old, I think this keeps getting pushed back more and more.
Like 40 is the new 20 and so on.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'll tell you one thing that does intrigue me. A lot of recent, you know, entertainment programs have featured, you know, Mr. Ford, you know, in front of the camera, and he seems to be having this really cool goatee going on. So I think there's something up, you know, probably a little bit more than we realize. So fingers crossed.
Well, you notice in interviews when they ask him about it, it's like he looks alive again. You can tell he's actually having fun. And I miss that Harrison Ford, because you can't be our age and talk about summer movies and not talk about Harrison Ford. I mean, he was the man, you know, for lack of a better word. And
yeah,
I miss that. I miss being genuinely excited about a Harrison Ford movie coming out.
And you know, he's done great work in the past. You know, Witness is one of my favorite movies, and you know, others along those lines. He's done good stuff. Of course, you know, we can't forget about Blade Runner. But you know, there is something special about this character, and I can say without hesitation, along with say the Lord of the Rings movies, that this is the only trilogy in movie history that I can think of, and I'm probably forgetting something right now. Actually, no, I am. Segway.
Do you really think you have a chance against our sadistic cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother.
And I am in charge of this situation.
Well, I got some bad news for you. From up here, that looks like you're in charge of Jack.
He is alone, he is
tired, and he hasn't seen Disney Squad from anybody down
here. Hey, pal, how you feeling?
With all things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
I want blood,
and you'll have it.
Only John can drive somebody that crazy.
He's an easy guy to like.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
And a hard man to kill. Bruce Willis, Die Hard.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Bruce Willis, my hero from Moonlighting, Mr. Dave Addison himself, at the time was not much in the way of a big movie star. Although he had done some great movies. He'd done Blind Date, terrific underrated comedy, In Country, superb movie about Vietnam, Sunset, kind of a Western thing with James Garner that we won't talk about, but they didn't really do a lot of business at the box office. And of course, you know, you and I, big Moonlighting junkies, you know, the show was pretty much on its last legs creatively. And then we hear that he's doing this action adventure. You know, it was like, oh God, you know, this sounds like a great idea. But started hearing some buzz about it. 70 millimeter, 6-track stereo. It's like, well, they're pulling out all the stops for this. This might be something worth checking out. And to me, you know, the finished product totally reinvigorated the action adventure movie. Because at the time, if you remember, you're getting stuff like Jade Speed, crap like that, and here comes, you know,
Hard Ticket to Hawaii.
Yeah, that kind of junk. For me, Bruce Willis in the Die Hard movies is the equivalent of how you felt about Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark and, you know, those other two films that followed. You know, I just love this character of John McClane. And you were a big fan of these movies too.
Yeah, especially the first one. I remember that. I remember the ads. Die Hard and 70 millimeter 6-track stereo, which just sounds, you know, it just sounds cool, because really, you know, back then I was like, I don't really know what that means. The screen's still just as big, but it's going to be really loud. And of course,
you know, we would have to go to a theater. I don't know if you saw it at the same venue that I did. Lovely full-track mono. And and it wasn't until the DVD came out when I heard this, coming from all directions, that I was really able to appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
And of course, by the time Die Hard 2 came out, we were able to see that in a theater that had multi-track Dolby surround, what have you, at the time, you know, marvelous audio. But this, there is something special about the first one, the feeling of discovery.
Yeah.
And I personally, at the time, loved the second one. But, you know, looking back, it was just maybe a little over the top. And it's really weird. You know, we were talking about Temple of Doom and Last Crusade. Mm-hmm. I found myself not really caring for Die Hard with a Vengeance. But yet, when it came on cable, I would be, you know, even if it was in the middle, I would find myself watching it. And it's like, you know, this isn't a bad movie.
It really improves. It is one of those I find, you know, if I'm flipping around channels, I'll wind up leaving it there. And it's a good movie. It's actually, I think it may be a little underrated. Nothing great. You're right, though, about the first Die Hard. It was that sense of discovery, that sense of, you know, it wasn't like, you know, 3 months earlier premiere, you know, had Die Hard on the cover, and, you know, Die Hard just 3 months from now, you know, kind of, you know, the studio, and I think most everybody knows this by now, you know, the studio was actually a little afraid of advertising Willis in it. And actually, I don't know, in a weird way, I have like a weird resentment for Die Hard in a weird way, and that I miss the funny Bruce Willis from Moonlighting.
Exactly.
And I wish that guy would kind of come back, because it seems like ever since Die Hard, I think there's a bit of an attitude, there's a bit of an ego that you can see there in a lot of his performances. And I don't like that. I miss the kind of geeky, funny guy from Moonlighting, and I wish he would get back to that.
I find myself kind of at odds with what you're saying, because I kind of like the attitude. I mean, he reinvented himself. I mean, I don't think that the David Addison routine would have worked well had he decided to take it to films. And I think it was kind of a neat evolution for him.
Well, no, you're right. I mean, you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again. Another thing about Die Hard is, if I'm right, I think, didn't it only gross really about maybe $80 million or something like that?
It became a bigger hit on video.
Right.
And yet, you know, we could kind of make the case for this being one of those movies that actually did better when it came out on video than it did in the theaters. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about Austin Powers, same situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, the second movie came out, you know, droves of people came to see it. And I remember when Die Hard 2 came out, there were lines, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in a weird way, it did kind of open up the act. Having Bruce Willis in it, I guess, did kind of open up the action movie, you know, where it didn't have to be Stallone or Schwarzenegger or, you know, it's still so odd that now you would automatically lump Willis into that stereotype, whereas at the time it was like, you know, calling the geeky guy next to you in algebra, you know,
it was
an action star.
Yeah, exactly. A breath of fresh air, and I love the character in the first movie. I mean, it's like a guy that you would get across the street to help you out with a lawn project or something. He was just like an average Joe, you know. I love that about his character. And there were some moments, you know, a little over the top, you know, I was talking to Bonnie Bedelia on the phone, and this is the Oscar moment, you know. But it was just, you know, I still love it. It's on, I'm going to watch it, or, you know, if I suddenly get into the mood, I'm going to slip it into the DVD player, because it's not just, I think it's gotten an unfair rap as a guy's movie, but I think women, you know, can relate to it as well, because, you know, he did love his wife, you know, granted they were separated at the time, but just, you know, it's kind of weird how a Christmas time, you know, hostage situation can bring you back together with your former significant other, you know?
And plus, you can't ignore the contribution of John McTiernan. I mean, it's just beautifully directed, and it's just the way it's shot, the composition, and there's just a leanness to it. It's that sort of thing. It's like you can't necessarily put your finger on it, but there is no fat in that movie, right. And it's just a joy to watch unfold.
Also, it was one of the first movies in which I learned the joys of letterboxing and just how much you were missing on your regular TV screen when they cropped it for television.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Die Hard showing on TV all the time with the look of the old Clint Eastwood movie where Bruce Willis is apparently
right.
9 feet tall. And
one thing I love about the Die Hard movies on DVD, they're still available in a terrific box set. There are so many extras on it that we don't have time to get into them, but if you like your action adventure movies and a ton of behind the scenes stuff in beautiful 235, Dolby Digital 5.1, DTS for all you DTS junkies out there, Die Hard is still available. I think all three movies are available separately, but if you love one, you're going to want them all.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
Talking about comedians and action roles. Okay, let's go ahead of here. Batman. Well, I'm talking about the casting of Michael Keaton. It was very much the same. That's very much the same thing you had kind of with Bruce Willis in Die Hard.
Yeah, it's like, okay, Michael Keaton was Mr. Mom. I see where you're coming from, you know, but just it seems like ever since he's done that, I kind of forgot about the comedian.
I know.
Night Shift and all that.
It's,
okay.
It's funny how that works. I think Batman really ushered in, maybe really what we could consider the modern era of the summer movie season and the big summer disappointment.
I can still see echoes of it in a lot of movies I've seen, and sadly to say, better movies, but
and that,
the buildup, I mean,
that, that's
incredible.
Not a, right.
That was.
Right. It's, I mean, and it's not a comment on the quality of the movie. I mean, the movie has its good points, and it certainly has its negative points. But what I remember more about Batman, and really, I guess in a weird way, maybe this may be my fondest summer movie memory, it was the buildup. It was all about the buildup. And then the day after the movie actually came out, it was like the day after Christmas, you know, and you didn't get what you wanted for Christmas. And you're like, huh, well, now what? You know, and I think, I don't know, do you think that conditioned us in a way to accept these movies that they were going to be disappointing?
It's been a while since I've experienced that, you know, Christmassy feeling with a movie, but I see where you're coming from, although I can tell you that I loved Batman Returns. I thought Batman Returns was a much
extremely
underrated.
I do too. It's like I've always said, it's like I don't know if Batman Returns is necessarily the Batman movie that I wanted, but it's definitely aged well. It's something that as the years go by, I love it more and more. And I certainly see why some people don't. But I don't know, I find something new in it every time I watch it.
And the thing is, you know, I don't want to belittle Jack Nicholson, who I thought was, you know, great in the first movie. But
really?
It just seemed like it was it's an underrated performance, but just I can see you feel differently.
Wait, you're calling Jack Nicholson and Batman underrated?
Maybe overrated by some people.
Overrated. And no, I mean, he did, for what they went for, I guess he did fine, but I don't know. I sit there and watch, and I think this is Jack Nicholson playing the Joker. I don't think that's the Joker.
Right.
I mean, when you were looking at Batman, you weren't thinking, that's Michael Keaton playing Batman. You're going, that's Batman.
He did a great job. The thing is, I felt really embarrassed when, you know, the studio told Burton to hand over the keys to the franchise, and, you know, we got two movies that we will definitely not talk about.
Yeah, let's not mention those.
Erase from our collective memories, but these first two films, you know, I'm probably going to go back and look at the original from 89 and just go, you know, it really wasn't that bad.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not bad, and it certainly has its good points. I guess really my main point there is it's not what we were hoping for. But although I would say even today, with as good as Batman Begins is, I still miss Burton stuff had like this freaky kick to it. You watched it and you knew you were looking at something unique, and I miss that visual flair. I wish there were a way, and I guess the budget would be just way too much, but I wish there were a way you could go in the direction they went with Batman Begins, but with the production design that they used and the Burton stuff. And if that movie ever got made, I would not leave the theater.
You know, I completely agree with the artistic direction, and I think they got some of that back with Batman Begins.
Oh, definitely.
And I'm really looking forward to the next one. But just, you know, these first two, the element of disappointment, but sometimes great stuff.
Yeah, but also, I don't mean to dwell on the negative there. I mean, it certainly had its cool points.
Last fall, we had a Batman anthology from Warner Brothers, and they went beyond the Call of Duty. I mean, it's just an amazing set. I haven't really gone through it as far as the extras, but just you got everything from like documentaries, commentary, the Dark Knight documentary, which I've heard was just great.
Those are awesome. Let's put it this way: when a DVD set manages to make the Schumacher Batman films interesting, at least in terms of the extras, you know, you really did something right there. And I mean, I'm a huge Batman fan, and I still haven't gotten all the way through the set. A lot of good stuff in there.
We got to give Joel Schumacher his props for apologizing for Batman and Robin, which was, of course, the godforsaken fourth sequel in the series. With, bless his heart, George Clooney, doing the best he could, talented guy, but just really wasn't meant to wear the cape. And as George often says on many a talk show, yes, I'm the guy that brought down the franchise. I don't think that's a fair thing for him to say, but it's really cool and I think self-depreciating in a Burt Reynolds kind of way.
It is very self-deprecating, and it is very cool of him to say.
Okay, Stan, yet another not-so-obvious choice, a movie that ushered in a new era of movie marketing, in my opinion, The Blair Witch Project. Any thoughts on that movie?
I liked it. I think that's a really interesting choice.
Because it seemed to be one of the first movies in which the net really played a role in the buzz and the marketing. Doing these really creative things that were fake, but just, you know, some people were kind of freaked out by it and thought it was real.
And I'm the same. Oh, I mean, I couldn't wait to see it. Even when I knew it wasn't real, I thought it was just a genius piece of marketing, if nothing else. And the film, I don't know. I don't know if it so much holds up today. I haven't seen it in a while. I liked it okay. I liked the ending in particular. But it really is one of those movies. It's like more than just the movie. I enjoyed everything around the movie. I enjoyed the books, the tie-in books, the way they did the whole mythology. I mean, I'm from a small town in Tennessee. I know what that's like. You know, the local legends, the, you know, out in the woods, that creepy feeling. And they really nailed some of that. And I think it was really more, like I said, really more the mythology around it that I think really helped sell it.
And I think it's a forgotten film. I can't believe that the buzz around this came and went so quickly, because
when I was doing research,
you know, it was kind of like, oh wow, the Blair Witch Project, I remember that. But it's like, gee, you don't really hear a lot of it on the AFI specials or what have you.
Yeah, well, I think that's because of the sequel. They shot themselves in the foot. They had a good thing there, and they shot themselves in the foot with the sequel.
It's really, you know, I haven't even seen the sequel, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you're not missing much. But I don't know. Do you think it's and I certainly see why you would pick this one. Do you think it's really revolution? Do you think we've learned anything from the way it was marketed? Can you think of another example? When I think the Blair Witch Project, and when I try to think of something similar, the only thing I can think of is what we're seeing right now with Snakes on a Plane. I think maybe the studio has a little something to do with that.
I completely see where you're coming from, Stan. Another thing that, you know, we can talk about is that this film was completely shot on a digital camera that's, I believe, they got at Circuit City, and they matched out their credit cards to get all the other equipment. I mean, I think this film is revolutionary and perhaps underrated. I think most of us are under the impression that, you know, you got to go to Hollywood, you got to have all this fancy equipment. You know, you got to be with the DGA and all that other stuff in order to make a film. But these people proved otherwise, and it made like, oh God, I think it crossed over $100 billion, if I remember.
But I think that's more a testament to the marketing than the actual film. I see what you're saying, and I think you have some good points there. But how many other movies since then have you seen shot that way?
American Movie. No, actually, American Movie, I think, was partially a documentary crew, but just that same spirit was there.
Because, I mean, you got to look at even, you know, before him, you know, Robert Rodriguez.
True.
Shooting stuff. And again, I think it had more to do with the marketing than anything else. Not to diss the film. I mean, I do enjoy the movie.
I have never seen an audience reaction to a film after this one finished. I mean, there was just like this eerie silence, and some people were like freaked. And some people were like walking out and just shaking their heads, and then you had people just like, ooh, that's good stuff, you know?
It's one of those things. I have a theory that no matter how bad your movie is, if the last 5 minutes is really good, that's what you remember.
That ending with the girl on her own and just nobody else out there, I mean, it's just, you know, it really was like my reaction to The Exorcist. Was just a very haunting ending. And, you know, this is a film that I think that a lot of us need to go back and take a look at again and see if it holds up. And that could be for a future show. Great movies we loved in the beginning, but do they suck now? I mean, it's a distinct possibility. I mean, who knows? I mean,
that's a good idea. I'm curious to go back and look at it now.
Oh, gosh. We got to talk about the DVD, which is still in print, but yet the company, Artisan, I think it's Lionsgate now. Who knows? But it had, in addition to all the usual stuff like, you know, commentary and what have you, the best extra on it has to be the Curse of the Blair Witch television documentary, which deserved some kind of award for these people just telling these stories with a straight face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, it's like I was saying earlier, everything they did around the movie, including the books, the specials, in a way, are better than the movie.
Yep, I completely agree.
But anyway, and this kind of leads into our next movie, in which I think was released pretty much around the same time, in that it all comes down to story. And how often, you know, these days, there's like, wow, I want to see this movie because of the story. Which brings us to our next one, which is The Sixth Sense.
You know the accident up there?
Yeah.
Someone got hurt.
They did?
A lady. She broke her neck.
Oh my God, but you can see her?
Yes.
Where is she?
Standing next to my window.
The Sixth Sense was one of those rare movies that didn't have to have a Roman numeral attached to its title or the stigma of an event movie, because it wasn't an event movie. I mean, it had a lot of buzz and stuff generated that people like you and I were privy to, but as far as the general public, other than having Bruce Willis in it, really wasn't much else attached to it. I mean, who had heard of Haley Joel Osment at the time? Who was familiar with Toni Collette? And yet, we went to see this movie and were just like mesmerized by the story and this incredible twist I don't think any of us saw coming.
Okay, you're not going to believe me, I saw it coming.
You did.
I saw it coming. But I gotta say, if I went into this movie cold, I probably wouldn't have. But when every single commercial on TV is talking about this great twist, and okay, spoiler warning for anybody who hasn't seen the movie, when every commercial is saying you're not gonna believe the twist ending, you know, I went into the movie thinking, okay, it's a kid. He sees dead people. He hangs around with Bruce Willis. He's dead. And that kind of ruined it for me. Although it has one of the best audience stories I ever remember. When
you got to tell the story, Steve.
About halfway through the movie, a guy about two rows behind me just blurts out of nowhere, "Yo, no, John Travolta's a ghost."
And this guy probably had like a couple of beers before he went to see the movie.
I think he was just kind of naturally dumb, but. I was like, wow, he's getting a much better value out of this movie because the movie he's watching is starring John Travolta. So there, you know, there could be singing and dancing in the version he's watching.
Exactly. And, you know, it's hard to tell the difference between those two. But
and I mean, I hate people talking during the movie, but if you're going to say something that unintentionally funny, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's one of the best I've ever heard. But I got to tell you, looking back at it, I think it's brilliant because I've gone back and watched it. You think a movie like that, I'll never appreciate it in the same way again. But the story was so well done. And, you know, when you watch it again, you watch the way they stage it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the storyline evolved. I mean, it was just a genius piece of work. And M. Night Shyamalan, you know, with the exception of Unbreakable, I don't think has really matched that movie yet. Unless, you know, I haven't seen Signs, I have to be honest, but
Signs is good. I haven't seen The Village.
Okay. And we heard a lot of not so good stuff about that. But, you know, I am intrigued, I have to say, by Lady in the Water. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed for a creative comeback with that.
Well, I got to give him props for being one of the few storytellers out there. No matter, say what you will about the quality of his movies, but when an M. Night Shyamalan movie is coming out, you are curious about the story.
True. And this guy, he may have hit a creative bump in the road, but I'm really hoping he gets it back because he just seems to be from the old school of filmmaking. Well, you know, it's always what he wanted to do, and mm-hmm. I think it's kind of cool that one of the extras on the version of The Sixth Sense that I have here in front of me is a Easter egg where you can click on it, if you're lucky enough to find it, no clues from us. You will see one of the first short movies he ever did as a kid, if not the first one. So, you know, he's evidently wanted to be the next Hitchcock since he was a kid, and I think if he can kind of get that groove back that he hit with this particular film, he might just be on his way.
So, okay, let me ask you a weird question here.
Sure.
In wrapping up, do you think the term summer movie even means anything anymore? I mean, since we have them, what we kind of think of as a summer movie, it seems like we almost have one opening every week now, regardless of the time of year.
You know, I hate to kind of contradict myself, but just, you know, judging by the way Premiere and Entertainment Weekly and all those, you know, entertainment rags that we're into, and I shouldn't say rags, because, you know, I actually enjoy reading that stuff, but, you know, I still feel a little sense of excitement every time May rolls around.
Oh, I do too, absolutely.
And I think that it still exists. I kind of wish that there wasn't as much product out there. I think there's way too many films. I wish that they would kind of let these things breathe and put these movies that they kind of have question marks about, you know, to the fall or whatever. And just, you know, just let people experience these movies sticking around for a long time.
Let them breathe a little bit.
Exactly. You know, I wouldn't have a problem.
Held over. Second big week.
I miss those headlines. If anybody can relate to what we're talking about, please, you know, send us a message in the comment section on the website.
Let us know. Is it just us? Is it just nostalgia? Or do you agree?
I think a lot of people, I don't think the younger generation understands what the hell we're talking about. The people past the age of, say, 35, I think do. But I wouldn't have a problem if these movies went off Thursday and arrived on DVD the following Tuesday. I just think that, you know, I think the studios are cheating themselves in a way. They talk about not making enough profit at times. But actually, you know, that's not the case this year, because I think the box office is up for like maybe 8 straight weeks in a row or something like that. I mean, we're having a good summer, but I thought last year's crops of movies were stronger. But then again, we're only halfway through this taping.
I think actually this is the weakest summer season we've seen in quite a while.
Really? Even with Superman Returns and Pirates of the Caribbean?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's a different topic for a different show. But overall, I mean, the movies certainly have some of their, you know, their positive points. But I think overall, I think it's been a very disappointing summer season.
But the legend of Ricky Bobby hasn't arrived yet.
And as we record this, the numbers aren't in yet for Little Man. So I think
let's don't go there.
We could have a next Sixth Sense there. I'm betting by the numbers that nobody did go there. But we can only hope.
Yeah, we can only dream. And our apologies to the Wayans family. Anyway, folks, that does it for this edition.
But you see, he's a man, but he looks like a little baby.
He looks like a baby.
And yeah. He kicks people in the groin. And wow. Summer's here.
Where's Bruce Willis when you need him? And that is going to do it for this special edition of the DVD Marquee. As always, we send our regards to the Home Theater Forum, the best home video discussion board on the World Wide Web at www.hometheaterforum.com. Big shout out to Ron Epstein, Packy, I've always wanted to say that, and everyone there. We appreciate your support. And, of course, we can't forget about iCraveDVD.com. You'll want to bookmark that site for this week. I'll be writing all about Warner Home Video's superb Tough Guys collection, which gathers 6 classic movies from the golden age of Hollywood, featuring James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, and Edward G. Robinson. The set includes G-Men, San Quentin, Each Dawn I Die, one of my favorites, and City for Conquest. Be looking for that review this week on iCraveDVD.com. paramounthomevideo.com. Looking ahead to our next show, I'll have Minnie Markey look at Paramount Home Video's She's the Man, the Amanda Bynes comedy, and later in the week, another special show catching you up on classic TV shows making the leap to DVD. Don't forget, you can get the word out about our podcast DVD confab by voting for us at podcastdaily.com. Just look under the Vote For Us section of our show site at www.thedvdmarquee.com. Are you paying attention, Stan? You're going to be doing some of this stuff down the road. If you're feeling more generous, we'd welcome your donations to help out with matters of bandwidth and what have you under the PayPal donation link on the site. We'll acknowledge your kindness on the air by name if you wish, or you can remain anonymous. Stan, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure. How
thank
was
you,
it?
I had a lot of fun. Thanks.
This wasn't so hard, was
thanks,
it?
Thanks for having me. I hope people actually enjoy listening to this.
And definitely, folks, if you have any comments about this particular show, we'd love to hear from you. Just click under the comments section of this particular episode, and we'll get back in touch with you, I promise. For Stan Williams, Shane McDonald, and the DVD Marquee, I'm Jeffrey Rosato. Until next time.